This is CliffCentral.com.
Please note that the views expressed and the advice provided in this show are for general advice and entertainment purposes only. Nothing stated should be treated as a substitute for your own independent legal advice based on your own specific facts and objectives. Therefore, the presenter and CliffCentral.com accept no liability of any nature whatsoever, either expressed or implied.
Law, like you've never heard it before. The Laws of Life, with Gary Hertzberg on CliffCentral.com.
I'm Gary Hertzberg, and this is the Laws of Life on CliffCentral.com. Alongside me today, Lionel Makoko-Taylor. Welcome, Lions.
Dumela, Gary, and Dumela to our podcasters, and good to see you once again, Gary.
Today's show is all about online fraud.
Sure.
Yep. Every day we read about how thieves are duping and scamming the innocent and are draining their bank accounts with impunity, Lions.
Sure. I know. That sounds very serious. I'm so looking forward to this one.
Yeah. Mm. It could happen to any of us. That's why we sit and listen and we sit in trepidation.
Hey, when you talk about 15% VAT, petrol price is going up. Now people are stealing.
Yeah,
hey, now that's, you are touching me on the wrong
side. Well, listen to this one, Lion. According to a crime and fraud survey that was published earlier this year by PwC, we in South Africa has the dubious honor of having the highest levels of crime in the world.
Wow.
So let's stand up and salute the world champions of crime levels.
Oh, DJ Gary is in the house.
Like, we play that tongue in cheek, but who wants to be the world champions of crime levels? That's right, said Fred. Stand up for the champions.
Yep.
Terrible. The tragedy, really, Lines, is that when it comes to cybercrime, a massive percentage of online phishing victims totally lose their money. The whole lot. They clean them out.
Mm-hmm.
And for one of the most targeted countries in the world, the question is, do our banks cover us for these colossal losses? And what is the law on online frauds?
Interesting.
Yeah. Everyone's wondering, well, if they get cleaned out, well, I'm insured, the banks will cover me. Well, are they really? And we're going to find out all about it. Our guest in studio today has been taking on the banks on behalf of victims.
Oh, that's good.
Of the online frauds. People who have lost their life savings to these disgusting human beings, these crooks.
Yeah.
The person that's helping them is Johannesburg attorney. He's a specialist in information security law. His name is Mark Hank. Welcome to you, Mark. Have I pronounced your name correctly?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Good morning, Gary. Good morning, Lion.
Thank you.
And good morning to the listeners.
Cool. Our partner today, Legal Talk South Africa, they're very interested in this one because I know that anyone out there has and could be scammed.
Certainly.
They have a Facebook membership. Can you believe now, Lions? It's 190,000
members. Yeah, it's growing. It's growing. That's good.
So our shows get pinned on their page and 190,000 people just from them alone.
But kudos to you, because you are the driver of this whole initiative, and without your contribution as well as your insightfulness, leadership, this wouldn't have been possible.
Yeah, Ray Green is the founder, really, Lion, so we always credit him. Our Facebook page, The Laws of Life, with Gary Hertzberg. Have a look, Lions. Yeah,
and at Hertz Law, that's basically our Twitter handle, HERTZLAW. That's where you can actually give us any topics that you would like us to really talk about. Just like today, we've got the best of the best to really unpack the complexity of this topic, just so that each and every single one of us can actually understand the basis of it.
Let me introduce Mark Hank in more detail. Apart from being a lawyer, Mark studied information management at Wits Graduate School of Business in 2004 as a certified information security systems professional as well. He's lectured on privacy law, different aspects of ICT law and information security law in practice, and he lectures to master's students, so you've got to know a whole lot to lecture to them. It's an honor for us to have Mark with us today. He's a member of the South African Law Reform Commission that researched and drafted the Protection of Personal Information Bill known as POPI. Yeah. to some of us, it's Poppy. And yeah, so Mark, have I left out? Tell me some more. What else have you been up to?
Well, I do a lot of work in information security. It's been an area where I've recognized that there is a gap in the law, and that we will, for certainly the rest of my professional career, and I think along after that, be trying to fill some of these gaps. And ensuring that the commercial and social realities of our lives are reflected properly in our law and that we give proper protection to those who need it.
Absolutely. Last month, Mark, I picked up in the money section of the Business Times of the Sunday Times, and this is a very well-read paper, under the heading, Mark Haink is fighting the cause of victims of internet banking fraud. And you've taken on a whole bunch of people, I think it's like 29, who have a problem with Absa. They were scammed, and they want their money back, and Absa stood their ground on this one. So 12 of these 29 people, I believe, are 65 years and older, have been cleaned out of life savings. Is it as bad as that?
It is, yes.
They have no reasonable prospect of ever recovering the money from the scammers, and the people they need to look at are the banks and say, well, you know, can you help us? Mm-hmm. Can you tell us about some of these cases, maybe go into a little detail so we know what the facts really are and how maybe we can identify with these?
Yeah. Well, the first thing is that these matters were referred to me by two computer experts who felt that the banks had not dealt with these clients correctly. There were initially 34 matters, and 29 of them are APSA. The other five matters I've actually were with other banks, and I've managed to settle all of those for the full capital of the claim. Mm. But APSA is very reticent and intransigent in the way that they're dealing with these matters, and the result has been that I'm now dealing with, not by choice, 29 matters against APSA, but by circumstance that these are the matters that were referred to me. Mm. So the nature of the crime is this. The first thing is that we all, with internet banking, we have banking credentials, we have user logons, passwords, etc. And these are compromised. How these are compromised is not always altogether clear, but certainly the banks put a large premium on phishing. And phishing is where we go into a site which looks perfectly innocent to us and possibly disclose information which we shouldn't. In a lot of the cases that I'm dealing with, there is no evidence of phishing at all. Mm. There are in some of them, but there is no evidence of phishing. It's also possible, of course, for your bank credentials and other information from computers to be hacked through malware, etc. And again, a lot of this could happen without the person actually knowing that it's happening. So what happens is with internet banking, with APSA's internet banking, that you use these credentials, obviously, to get into your bank account. And then once those credentials are obtained, there's a second element, really, to how these crimes with SIM swaps have occurred. Now, a SIM card is something that is used in your cell phone, mobile phone, and typically the numbers are directed to that SIM card. And obviously, people do change their devices that they use, and they would normally just take out the SIM card and put it into another device. They could also lose a device, and they might go back to the service provider and ask for, quite legitimately, that they get another SIM card so that they can put it into the device that they've just acquired. Yeah. In those circumstances, obviously, that's perfectly legitimate. But the loophole that the criminals have seen in what happens with internet banking is that one-time passwords, which are a security measure which has been developed by the banks, and I talk about APSA specifically here, are then provided to the client so that once they are into their internet banking, What APSA itself describes as high-risk transactions, like the creation of beneficiaries or the changing of limits on the accounts, etc., those can only be authorized with the use of the one-time password. So having purely your banking credentials without having the one-time passwords does not allow the criminal to actually channel funds into accounts over which they have control, because your internet banking account would not have that particular account as a beneficiary. However, with the SIM swap, where a SIM swap is performed, they might have control over your credentials and that further factor of security, the one-time password, which allows these transactions to then actually occur. And this is the nature of the matters, those 29 matters that we're talking about. That's the nature of the crime. Now, one of the things is that the banks say, well, if we...
Sorry, Mark, let's just slow down a little understand it. When I do a transaction on the internet, a one-time password is sent to my cell phone,
mm-hmm.
and then I take that one-time password and I put it into the internet, and the transaction goes through.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay, that's normal for everyone, basically.
Well, just let's stop here a second. Certain transactions you won't need one. But
for creating a new beneficiary,
absolutely,
I need that one.
That's correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
Where have these people gone wrong, as opposed to me? I mean, could it happen to me that somebody swapped my SIM card? How is it that someone got to swap their SIM cards? There's 29 people. Does that make sense, Line?
It does make sense, because I think also in South Africa, most celebrities have been quite a number of them to this scam. So, yeah, it's quite...
How do the thieves get to swap their...
Well, typically they masquerade as the person if it's necessary. Otherwise, they might well have somebody within a service provider who is in on the crime that they are committing, or they pay them off to be able to do it.
Why is it that there's a number of elderly people, 65 and older? What did they do wrong? Or is it just coincidental, or is it a fact that the elderly probably made mistakes in this?
Well, I think that in a lot of instances there's not even any evidence of the elderly making any mistake. It might just be, and it is a small profile, but still, there are 40% of the people that I'm dealing with that are in this position. I don't really know what to ascribe it to. It may be that there is this generational divide with digital devices and internet banking, but certainly the evidence that I have is not that these people succumb to a phishing expedition. There's no evidence of that in a number of cases, and we have had their devices forensically investigated to confirm that that's the case.
So in each and every one of these cases, has it been a SIM swap that's caused the loss, the theft?
Well, it's a combination of having the banking credentials and the SIM swap. Mm. And that is what has caused the loss in these particular frauds that we're dealing with here.
When you say the banking credentials, what have the thieves got that's not in the public domain? My bank account is floating around all over the place. I give it out. I say to you, if you please, will you deposit money into my account? I send it out by email or by WhatsApp, whatever. It's out there. So everyone knows what my bank account number is and my name and my bank and my branch code.
Sure. No, certainly they will have those credentials, but they should not have your password or PINs, which you should be selecting.
Okay.
And the bank's argument is that nobody aside from you should know those credentials.
How do the thieves get hold of that?
Well, it can be through a phishing expedition, where in a phishing expedition, typically what will happen is that it would appear that it is something from a bank, or in my particular instances from APSA, where the client is asked to provide the PIN and password.
So they've got an email from someone that says, hey, we from the bank, we just want you to fill in a few details, and that's what they fill in, and that's what the thieves get hold of.
Yeah.
Or they go onto a site that's, as you said, dishonest. And
There is another manner of attack. I mean, there are lots of different attacks that are being used by the criminals. But it is also, for instance, you might download malware, which you don't even know about. It is you've gone in, you've seen something that seems perfectly legitimate, not even related to your bank. It is downloaded malware onto your device, and that malware might have a keylogger, which actually then logs all of the keys that you're pressing. And obviously, once the criminals are sophisticated, and they'll be able to pick up whether there is a login to a bank and the type of information that would go in there. And therefore, they'd be able to pick up PINs and passwords that might be used in those circumstances. And of course, the bank's argument is that we cannot control how people protect their information.
Can the bank show how the people lost the information to the thieves, how the thieves got a hold of it? Can they show that you... I don't know what. What are they trying to say, the banks? Are they just saying there's a loss and we're not responsible?
Well, they can, because...
Or are they saying you were negligent or grossly negligent?
Well, I think that there are two elements to this. The first element is that the bank says that you are responsible for looking after your PIN, etc. And that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. We should, in the normal course, be careful about how we deal with this.
Yes.
However... when these matters do actually arise, in many instances the banks do not investigate whether the person was actually negligent in any way or not. And my experience
is... That's your point, isn't it? That the banks are just simply shrugging their shoulders, throwing their arms up and saying, we're not paying. And we'll give the reasons why.
Well, the point is that the reasons, I don't think, are great in a lot of cases, because what they're saying is that simply because your banking credentials have been compromised, and the very strong interpretation that can be put in on a lot of the correspondence and communications that clients have with the banks is that they were negligent, that they did something wrong. Now, as a lawyer, Gary, you will know that our law requires for there to be negligence that you either have to do something that you shouldn't have done, or you have to not have done something that you should have done.
Yes.
Absent that, there can't be negligence.
Can the bank show the negligence?
Well, in my experience up to now, they have not been able to show the negligence. But they don't rely purely on the negligence. They use that in trying to say to people, you have probably been had your information phished. And in a lot of instances, that is just not the case. That's not true. They have no evidence to be able to support that. So they just simply are going on the basis of, on a balance of probabilities, our systems, and they say our systems worked perfectly, so...
you must have done something wrong.
You must have done something wrong. And the interesting thing about that is, of course, is that they never allow their systems or the forensic reports around their systems to be investigated independently. The client just simply has to accept that that's what the bank is saying.
Well, the banks have got millions and millions of customers. There's only a very small percentage that are being duped. They are saying that these people must have done something wrong. Otherwise, that's really their point. They justify it by trying to rely on some law called assumed risk. Tell me what that is.
Well, to understand assumed risk, we must first of all understand our relationship with our banks. In terms of our law, we have what is called a debtor and creditor relationship. So when we deposit money in a bank, or if we are given money by the bank on credit that is in our particular account, there's not a neat little pile of money that's saying this is Gary Hertzberg's money, and when a payment is made that it is taken out of that. There's simply an account. And if money is paid into that account, it must be credited. And if money is paid out of that account, it must be debited, but only if the money is paid out on the authorization of the account holder. I think we all understand that it is part of what we understand around our banking. So to circumvent that with internet banking, where the authorization, and in all of these cases, the bank has conceded that it is not the account owner that has made the authorization for the payment to be made. They know that.
Mm.
So to get around that, they say, okay, we have terms and conditions relating to our internet banking or our e-channel, in terms of which, if your banking credentials are used, then you will be liable. We can assume that that is you, and you will be liable for any loss. We are not liable as a bank for any loss that is suffered unless you can show that there's negligence on the part of the bank itself. Now, the first thing about those terms and conditions is that that is an assumption of risk. You're changing the liability that the banks would normally have in terms of the banker-client relationship to a liability on the actual client.
Mm-hmm.
And it is necessary in terms of the Code of Banking Practice as well as the Consumer Protection Act that the bank notifies and draws the attention of the client to those particular provisions.
Where are these conditions that you talk about?
Well, this is the interesting point, and that is that we are told that that in some cases there would have been a document signed by our normal manuscript signatures. And more recently, it seems to me that the allegation is now that these are terms and conditions that you would have accepted electronically. Okay. Now, the point is, let's assume for a moment that in fact the client did sign them. In the 29 cases that I'm dealing with, without exception, I've asked the clients and they've said no, they do not remember signing an agreement, but they do not deny that that's a possibility.
Yes, I mean, Lyons, you wouldn't deny that you had signed something.
Yeah.
Or that you'd have agreed to something when you opened the account.
That's
it may well be. It says there the terms and conditions on our website are applicable to whatever. We don't know. It's something that we just close our eyes to. Yeah.
What has happened, though, in every single matter that I've dealt with relating to APSA, that I've asked for the account, for the agreement, they have not been able to provide the actual agreement to me. They refer to generic conditions, etc. And it is up to the bank to prove that if they are relying on a contract, it is up to the bank to prove that there was, in fact, an agreement in place.
Yes.
But it is also up to the bank to comply with its obligations in terms of the law, the Consumer Protection Act, their own Code of Banking Practice, which they adhere to, or claim that they adhere to, and commit themselves to, which says that if there is an assumption of risk, that must be drawn to the attention of the client. Now, as I say, in all of these cases, in not one of the cases has anybody been able to show me that that has been done. And therefore, the clients themselves, again, without exception, say we are prepared to go an affidavit to say that if these provisions were brought to our attention properly, that we understood the assumption of risk, we may not have actually entered into the agreement at the time. And certainly one or two of them have said to me, I would have then wanted to know how I can ensure that this risk can be avoided. So they are prepared to go on oath to say that.
I think it's fair to accept as a consumer that I wouldn't know as a lawyer even where these conditions are.
Exactly.
If you said to me, Gary, you're an online banker, I'd say... a customer might say, yes, sir, I don't know about conditions. I don't know where they are.
Yeah, you may find it small print as well.
Yeah, I may have agreed to them somewhere. I don't know where they are. Show them to me. Did I agree to them?
Yeah.
I think that's your point.
Yes, my point is that at this stage, that the APSA has certainly not shown us these agreements that they appear to rely on in repudiating the claims.
Sorry, have all the claims been repudiated in full, or have they settled some, or have agreed to settle? Or
no, in certain instances, and I'm not 100% certain of the numbers, but I think that in 15 of the 29, there have been settlements. Now, what has happened in those cases is the bank have said, we won't admit any liability. It is not our fault at all. We will settle with you on the basis that we will pay you 50% of the claim.
Take it or leave it.
Take it. You've got 7 days to accept this. And one of the conditions is confidentiality. So what has occurred in a lot of these cases is that the, in my view, the client is in an impossible position. In the one particular instance, the client...
He's desperate. They've been cleaned out.
Yeah. Well, a retired couple, which who between them had been cleaned out, and they had 381 rand between them. They were not in a position to not accept the offer. And the type of comment that I've got from my clients is that we felt that we had a gun to our head. We had absolutely no option. That, you know, in the one particular instance where business was involved, the lady said, I did not have money to pay my salaries if I did not accept the 50%, and I could not make my employees, I could not make my problem my employees' problem. I had to accept it.
How much is involved here, Mark? How much has been stolen?
Well,
Of the
29 matters, and I don't have the figures in front of me, but the total amount which has been lost, the total loss...
It's stolen. How much has been stolen?
The amount stolen was probably in the region of, over the 34 matters that were initially provided to me, that was in the region of about 22 million.
Wow.
And there are some big claims. There's one particular claim, which is 4 million rand.
What kind of people are these? Are they retired? Are they retired, or that lost 4 million?
Well, in that particular case, the lady who unfortunately is now deceased,
she died from this, I'm sure.
She was an elderly lady. She was 91, and yes, she is from a wealthy family, etc. But certainly, you know, she was one of the elderly people there, but it's across the board, Gary.
Was her money in a current account, in a normal check account? Was this 4 million?
Well, the money, that's part of what occurred there, is that the money had been paid in shortly before the scam actually occurred, okay? And part of her question is, and, you know, there's no answer to this, but part of the question that was, her question was, how did they know that that money had come into my account at that time? And, of course, the banks will disclaim that there is anything wrong, but the problem is it's impossible
to find out.
And the information that is provided by the banks, I mean, in a number of instances now, despite the fact that they, I believe, have known that they should be providing certain of the information, it has been necessary to bring applications to court to get the information.
Yes.
So we have the situation where not only do the banks are not the party that's actually suffered the loss because they've just simply debited the client's account, but they also have the monopoly on the information that is necessary to be able to deal with these matters. And that is, that places the client in a very, very invidious position in how they actually deal with it. And is one of the reasons that litigation is incredibly risky, apart from the fact that for any man in the street to litigate against any bank or big financial institution, in the knowledge that that they do not have the financial wherewithal to be able to match the bank in court, we have that problem.
Yes.
But we also have the problem that to actually equip themselves to be able to go to court, they need to get information which the bank simply withholds in a lot of instances.
Are the banks insured against losses?
This is a question that is that I'm not certain of at all. I think that in a lot of cases the banks self-insure, and nobody has actually been forthcoming around how this is dealt with from an insurance aspect. So I'm really not certain. I can't answer that question fully.
The matter with the 4 million for the deceased 91-year-old, that's ongoing.
Yes, it is ongoing.
I mean, was she operating the bank herself the account?
No, in that instance, her daughter was actually operating the account.
Yeah.
And her daughter, again, we've actually had her devices looked at. forensically looked at, and there's nothing that we can find that she would have done wrong for this to actually have occurred.
Mark, you took this to the banking ombud.
Yes.
And what was the reaction there?
Well, what we did with the ombud, let's...
You took all these matters?
No, I did not all of them. The ombud was dealing with certain matters. And and remember that, for instance, the 4 million rand matter, the ombud only has jurisdiction up to 2 million rand.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Mm. So that's one of the issues. And even in one particular case where the amount was marginally over 2 million rand that we wanted to take to the ombud, the bank just refused to consent to allow us to do that.
Mm.
But the essence of it is this, that we went to the ombud having looked at a lot of matters where the ombud had actually come to an assessment or determination. They said to the clients that there is no reasonable prospect of success. And the rather formulaic process that they adopted was that they obviously get a complaint, they then ask the bank to provide them with information, and in virtually without exception, it was the basis of the decision appears to have been that the bank has said that their systems worked perfectly. Of course, those forensic reports remain confidential. The ombud won't allow you to look at those forensic reports. And on that basis, and again, even where it is clear that there has not been negligence on the part of the client, the ombud said, you must be negligent. They used those words, you must be negligent. In fact, they went as far as saying, you handed your information to the criminals. That is put in writing.
Wow.
They make that statement.
But that's not even
the evidence, is it?
No. There's no evidence to support that, and in my view, the ombud in dealing that really did misdirect themselves, because that is almost a defamatory statement and almost insinuates that there was collusion or that the person was in fact complicit in what actually occurred. So we actually approached myself and two counsel, one eminent senior counsel at the Joburg Bar.
What's his name? You want to mention it?
I don't think I should, because I don't have his permission. But nonetheless, they have been assisting me.
Yeah.
We visited the ombud with a view to seeing whether these matters could be reviewed, because there is a process of review around the ombud. And we were told, no, they can't be reviewed. And the ombud has steadfastly just refused to actually take any of those matters further. Obviously, we have now, more recently, also applied for assistance, which is the process that is called, that is named at the ombud, to look at some of the other matters. And we've set out and asked the ombud to look at the issues of, for instance, is there an agreement? Because it does not appear at all that the ombud actually looked at those issues.
Mm-hmm.
Now, bear in mind that these people were not represented previously by lawyers.
Are you allowed to have a lawyer at the ombud's office?
Well, the ombud discourages it.
Yeah, I've actually seen here, it says on their website, the question is posed, do I need a lawyer? And the response of the ombud is, no, we discourage the use of lawyers and other bodies who charge for their services. We employ qualified lawyers who can assist in obtaining relevant facts from both the complainant and the bank. And we are strictly impartial, so there's no need for a lawyer. That's what they really say. And really, if you do get a lawyer, you are unlikely to get any legal fees from the bank. So that's what's on their website.
But it doesn't look like they are really neutral in this case, because it seems like whatever they base their statement on or their outcome, it's based on what the other party is actually saying.
I think that's what your point is, Mark.
First of all, let me stress, I'm not saying that the bank, the ombud has not acted impartially.
Mm.
I believe that they've misdirected themselves in not looking at all of the facts, despite what they say about lawyers, etc. They've not looked at the background of the agreements which the bank actually relies on.
Mm.
The bank doesn't say that the client has been negligent, as far as I'm aware, when it speaks to the ombud. So I don't know, because, again, that information is privy only to the ombud and the bank, what is actually being said there. But if the bank is saying that the client has been negligent, that's a misdirection in itself.
Well, I think you're entitled to know in what manner has the client been negligent. Yeah. Isn't that what it's all about?
Well, precisely. Yeah.
And you've never been shown that. Is that what's upsetting your clients?
Yes,
please
exactly.
Show us where we've been negligent.
Yes.
If we have been negligent, then maybe they'll accept it.
Yeah.
We don't know.
No.
You've now gone, you've referred all the matters to the Financial Sector Conduct Authority. Who is this body?
It's it's not a new body in itself, in that there was a Financial Services Board for many, many years.
Mm.
But there's been new legislation which has reconstituted this body into the Financial Sector Conduct Authority. And among their many obligations, as you can understand, in the financial sector, there's a plethora of regulatory issues that need to be looked at. But among those responsibilities is the conduct of the banks themselves and of the ombuds in the financial sector. So what has been necessary in that regard is, and we don't know at this stage, I've put together the submissions. Saying that my clients are unhappy with the way that they've been treated by the banks and by the ombud, and I've asked that they are investigated.
Mm.
At this stage, there aren't regulations which tell us exactly how this might happen. One hopes that this will happen relatively quickly, but there aren't even any time periods that I know. So we are waiting on understanding how the Financial Sector Conduct Authority, we've given them a fairly, I hope, concise but clear view of what has occurred in these matters.
Mark, you may or may not want to answer this. Yeah. Are you doing this pro bono, or how are you doing this?
I agreed on the 34 matters that were initially provided to me that I would act pro bono. It has cost me a great deal of time and money.
I have
to
no
be able
doubt.
To,
yeah, Jesus, you've put in a lot of work on this.
But at the end of the day, you know, I feel that this is an area of law that really needs to be looked at carefully. I believe that there is a huge unfairness, and that if we look at other jurisdictions, there are limits on the loss that will be suffered by the client in these circumstances. Certainly, for instance, in the United States, if this happened in the United States, as long as you reported the incident within 2 days of it becoming your knowledge or coming to your knowledge, you would have the limit of your liability, of your client's liability, would be $50. The rest would have to be borne by the banks. And in my view, as we move into the information society and we have big business who are obviously benefiting enormously from the technologies and have the ability to put in the controls, etc., that are necessary, that they should be the ones that are looking out more carefully. It is impossible for the man in the street to protect himself against some of these crimes. Yeah. And this has been the case in these matters.
Why is it, Mark, that we South Africans have become such a targeted prey by thieves and fraudsters? Are we a bit naive? Why are they hammering us? Why go somewhere else? Go to Croatia or go to France? But why us?
Well, I think first of all it's a very good question, in the sense of we are a country which has a good banking system that has strong technology behind the banking system and is well regulated. And, you know, these crimes are not confined, obviously, to banks, etc., but the criminals go to where the money is. Mm. And the money is all with banks and in the financial sector. And one of the reasons is very clearly to me the fact that the raw material for these crimes is personal information.
Yes.
Mm. Personal information in so many forms. And as South Africans, because we've not had protection of personal information effectively enforced in our country for so long, our information has been simply plundered. And we are also, and I cannot, I would love to be able to answer this question, because it amazes me that we are quite apathetic about.
You've said that
about some of the hacks that have occurred. You know, there are a lot of well-publicized hacks that are in the media for a day or two, and then they just seem to disappear.
Let's talk about Liberty as an example. Mm. That happened very recently.
Yes.
They hacked into Liberty's system. Mm. Am I right about that?
Yes.
What happened to that?
Well, we just simply don't know. Mm. And I think one of the things about the Liberty hack, and again, you know, I also want to be try and be fair to all of the parties involved. I don't know all of the details of the Liberty hack. Mm. So I cannot really give the background on whether Liberty were not sufficiently diligent or not.
Mm.
But the point is that the attitude of Liberty was something that struck me as a little odd. And that was that there was a strong emphasis on there being no financial loss to their clients, which, of course, is critically important. However, it was almost the fact that there was so much personal information that seems to have been hacked into by way of emails, and you will know, you're talking to your financial advisor,
mm.
and you might tell them that you're going to buy a home, or that you need money for this, or you have this investment that's maturing. This is a very, very sensitive information. And to play down the fact that it was merely emails actually gives credence to the fact that we are not looking at the protection of our personal information correctly.
True.
We've had a number of these of instances where we've had millions and millions of records, of personal records that have been out in the open. The information regulator has yet to be functionally operative. And you know, I was on the South African Law Reform Commission that investigated privacy in 2002.
Mm.
It took a long time, and there seemed to be unnecessary delays to put this very important legislation in place. And I say that it is very important because it's not just very important in the South African context. Information has no borders. So we see in other countries around the world a huge strengthening of the ability of the man in the street to protect and know who is dealing with their information.
Mm.
And where that information is compromised, that the enforcement agencies in those countries come down very hard on the parties that whose information it is, the parties who were responsible for the security of that information.
Talk to us, Mark, about how the prosecution and the police, what's happening on that level? Talk of what the police did in these 29 cases that you may know of.
Well, in the 29 cases that I know of, in each one of them, the matters were properly reported from all the information that I have to the police, and there's been no meaningful response.
I mean, wouldn't they be the ones to determine whether there was some negligence? Wouldn't they have gone into the minutiae of the transactions to determine how they happen?
I think ideally one would like that to be part of what they're doing.
Mm.
The problem is that we do not have the capacity. I mean, even at all sorts of different levels within our police force, there are capacity problems. But we do not seem to have trained sufficient people in what is now part of our lives, our lives are in, are conducted largely in an electronic type of sphere. Mm. And we have not trained people to be able to do this. Also, we've not trained prosecutors to take what might have been found in investigations to court and prosecute these properly. Mm. And one wonders, there have not been many cases that have come before the courts in these matters. But also one wonders whether our judges are sufficiently facile with some of these things for them to be dealt with properly in court. And that's not a comment on South Africa, because I think that this is a problem that is faced worldwide. But certainly we have not done enough. And I think one of the things that is important in this regard is just to go back to the Ombud and the issues of SIM swaps, where one of the things that the Ombud has done is that they've simply refused in the matters that we've had, that I've dealt with to date, to actually even investigate SIM swaps. They say, well, that's outside of their jurisdiction. They don't have control over the mobile service providers. And that might be true. But what they are missing is that the security measure is a security measure which has been instituted by the banks. Mm. It is the bank's security measure. The fact that the one-time password is communicated through a mobile service provider, in my view, that makes that mobile service provider the agent of the bank in this instance, and not the agent of the client. And therefore, it is, and best practice around information security tells us that where you put a security measure in place, it is up to you to ensure that that security measure works properly. Now, against that background, apart from anything else, while there's been a lot of talk about phishing by the banks, and there are lots of alerts about phishing, I find nothing around SIM swaps that the banks have actually told their clients about and how they should possibly protect against SIM swaps.
Is there a way to protect?
Well, you can go, for instance, to your mobile service provider and say to them, unless I am actually present and I give you my information, do not swap my SIM. And again, that's not well known. The service providers say that they will do that. And certainly if they've done that and you have a record of that, that gives you some protection that the measure that the bank has put into place, the bank's measure, if that fails, you are protecting them from the loss that might be suffered by or that they attribute to you. And, you know, in that regard as well, SIM swaps are not new. SIM swaps have been around for 7 or 8 years.
Yes.
It has been well known in that time that there are mechanisms around SIM swaps, or the SIM swap is a mechanism to be able to defeat one of the control measures that the bank has actually said is in place for high-risk transactions. Mm. Therefore, the issue of the duty of care, should the banks have been more careful in telling clients that there is this danger, and should they have told clients a whole lot more about the SIM swap instead of relying purely on the fact that they had an agreement in place and repudiating liability on that basis?
Mark, before we end off, what kind of advice could you give our listeners as to protection? How do they protect themselves?
Well, the first thing is that, like all types of protection, you have to be aware of what the risk is. You know, if we don't understand the risk, very often we don't protect ourselves. We're very aware in South Africa of the risk of our homes being broken into, and we do very well typically by putting up the
electric fencing,
electric fencing, and you know, very strong locks and all the rest of it. And we have to take that type of approach into the electronic world, where we just simply don't accept exactly what is being told to us. That when we are entering into agreements, we ask about these things where there might be a risk around what we are doing electronically.
Sorry, Mark, the problem with that is when I question the bank and I say I'm not entering into this transaction, they tell you to take a hike, and you won't get an account opened, or you won't be able to do electronic banking. So I guess we are forced to conclude these unknown agreements, if I can call it that.
Well, in a way, I think that is the truth. But I think that part of it is must also come to our responsibility. You asking me how we protect ourselves, that we have to become far more aware of what the risks are and what the protections might be. So very simply, you know, if you are using an out-of-date computer or a computer that the software is out of date, well, the risk is higher because the chances of there being a vulnerability are higher. The chances of there not being the proper malware protection that you might have loaded onto it are higher.
Yes.
The changing of your passwords and creating strong passwords. You know, we pretty intuitively know about keys and locks.
Yeah.
And we will have a fairly simple mortise lock in an interleading door in our home. But we will not use that same lock, for instance, in our front door. We would use a far stronger lock. And that is part of what we just know intuitively. When it comes to passwords, people don't have that intuition, and we should spend a lot more time, in my view, in our organizations and people like banks, etc., in explaining to clients what a strong password is mm-hmm. and why we should have a strong password. Because that is the key that we are using to unlock the information that is very dear to us, and that could create a lot of loss for us if it is not protected.
Mm. Wow.
Excellent. Lines, anything before we let Mark
go? Yeah, and I, just to add to that, I think people must actually look at their statement on a monthly basis. You know, those 999 that keeps going out without actually looking into that. It's actually very important. But another one, please try not to use internet cafes to do your banking, because people actually try to steal your contact details via that.
Yeah, well done, Mark. You're trying to help these people, and we'll have to await the result.
And the mere fact that he's doing it pro bono, that's quite amazing. And this is it looks like a very huge project on its own.
Mm. We've been talking to Mark Heink, H-E-Y-I-N-K. Your practice is in Johannesburg.
That's great.
We Google Mark's all over the place, M-A-R-K.
Yeah.
Many thanks to you, Mark. It's been very interesting, and I think we've learned quite a lot from this. We'll talk to you again. To our listeners, thank you for listening. Until next week, it's Lionel Makokotlele and myself, Gary Hertzberg. Many thanks. Cheers for now.
Thank you.
This is CliffCentral.com.